Edwina Farley with you for A Country Breakfast on RN. I can't wait to share some of our stories with you this week as we celebrate the wealth of ways in which Indigenous Australians contribute to our rural life.
Well, Dad learned me how to track and find food when we used to work on a cattle station like that, look for cattle and horses and look for their track and which way they're heading to, and you have to find them and bring them back to the camp.
We're celebrating the powerful role Indigenous Australians have played, from the great pastoral stations to the delights of bush tucker. But before we celebrate NAIDOC Week, let's find out what's been making news this week with Kath McAloon. Morning, Kath.
Good morning, Edwina.
We had some more activity, I suppose, on what is really one of those ongoing stories for rural industries around animal welfare.
The People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA as they're known, released footage this week of shearers punching and stomping on sheep. PETA claims that this footage was taken in 19 different Australian shearing sheds, and it's been released as part of a campaign to stop people buying and wearing wool. So the footage is being shown to fashion houses, and PETA's also running a petition on their website to get people to send a message to fashion houses not to use wool. PETA says that the footage was taken at shearing sheds in South Australia, New South Wales and Victoria. This, of course, follows their very high-profile campaign against mulesing. The group's Australian campaign coordinator, Claire Fryer, says some of the people that were filmed in this most recent footage were aware that cameras were in place at the time.
Footage shows the workers violently punching sheep in the face, stomping and standing on the animals' heads and necks, beating them in the face with electric clippers and even a hammer. And it's also important to mention that there were station managers, farmhands, and were affiliated with the producers in some sheds, and no one was remanded for any of the abuse.
So PETA says that it will pass on some of this information to police and ask them to investigate the footage and proceed with criminal charges if they deem necessary. The response from the industry has been, I guess, one of, you would expect, saying that they categorically and unequivocally condemn the mistreatment of animals. That's what the Australian Wool Innovation Group has said. They say that they've invested millions of dollars in training shearers and shed hands in world's best practice animal welfare just in the past year alone. So
yes, it's interesting. It was one of the points mentioned by the outgoing head of the National Farmers Federation that there would be a shift, and we've already seen that happen. Happening in these welfare campaigns, from sort of, you know, attacking industry broadly to looking at individual farms and individual industries. It's going to get a whole lot more interesting, I would imagine, in the months to come.
Absolutely.
Now, we also heard some statistics, some official statistics, I suppose, about the value of live exports, another relatively controversial area.
The Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Resource Economics and Science has released figures this week looking at the value of live exports. And the report suggested that reducing livestock exports wouldn't directly translate to an increase in boxed or chilled beef exports from Australia. So animal rights groups, as well as the Greens and independent MP Andrew Wilkie, have long argued that chilled or frozen meat exports would be a viable alternative to live exports, which are controversial, with animal welfare groups opposed to them. The Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, says that this latest report suggests that it wouldn't be a viable alternative because there are cheaper suppliers of boxed beef in the international market than Australia. And the report also raised issues around refrigeration not being sort of common practice in some of the export markets. But a global animal welfare organisation says the report is flawed. Tom Shannon is from the World Animal Protection, and he says, citing a lack of refrigeration and cold chain facilities in Middle East markets doesn't stand up as a critical driver of the live export trade.
We know from research done in 2011 that in countries in the Gulf Cooperation States, there is near universal household ownership of refrigerators. And in countries like Indonesia, which is becoming increasingly urbanized, households in cities have up to a 68% household refrigeration rate.
Now, looking at the use of chemicals in farm production and on food that we eat, obviously a very big issue for consumers, but also for farmers.
Yeah, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority has restricted the use of an organophosphorus insecticide known as fenthion. It's restricted the use of this on soft skin fruits, and this issue is being reviewed by the Senate's Rural and Regional Affairs Committee. And parts of the horticulture industry are anxiously awaiting the outcome of this Senate inquiry. Many fruit and vegetable growers use fenthion to protect their crops from pests like fruit fly. And fruit grower Kay Wilson, who has a farm on the far north coast of New South Wales, says that her income fell by 30% last year because of the restrictions.
And you're throwing away fruit fly infested fruit. Fenthion has been in use for 45 years with no known side effects to human health, and we're under far more strict regulations, and through no fault of our own, we're losing half our income.
But the Pesticides Authority is concerned that fenthion used at low levels could lead to vomiting, nausea and diarrhoea, while higher level exposure, they say, can cause death. So the Senate committee is still looking into this issue and are expected to report back next week.
That will be very interesting. Now, since the federal budget and the proposed changes to higher education, we've been talking a bit about agriculture courses and a reason this week to jump the ditch.
Yeah, a New Zealand university is claiming that it could cost students more than twice as much to study a three-year agricultural degree in Australia than it would in New Zealand. So the Christchurch-based Lincoln University says if the Australian federal government's proposed changes to university funding take effect, an ag degree would cost about $120,000 in Australia compared to around $50,000 in New Zealand. So quite a significant gap there. The university's Assistant Vice Chancellor Jeremy Baker says inquiries from Australian students have already doubled.
Today we've got 24 Australian students enrolled at Lincoln. Around half of them are doing agricultural degrees. So to saying around 50 have inquired, which is a pretty big jump for us.
We've talked a lot about the honey shortage and the effects of the dry weather on the bee industry, but some fairly extreme steps being taken by Queensland beekeepers.
About half of Queensland's 100 commercial beekeepers have decided to cart their bees more than 1,000 kilometres to breed them up during what's been a pretty dismal local season. The bees rely on trees like spotted gum and ironbark in their breeding cycle, but because of a really dry summer, some of those plants haven't been flowering. So now beekeepers, including Roy Barnes, who's from Maryborough, are trucking their hives down south to canola crops in New South Wales. And Mr. Barnes says it's coming at a big cost.
Well, you've got the truck expenses going down, so at the moment I'm operating about 1,000 kilometres from my base, so you just work out what it costs to run big trucks, 2,000k round trip, but when you've got no options, you have to do it. Yeah, it is worth it.
I guess we'll all just have to expect to pay a bit more for our honey, Kath.
Yes, perhaps that's the case.
Thank
Not
you
quite
for that.
As sweet.
No, absolutely. Thanks, Kath.
Thanks, Edwina.
Kath McAloon with The Week in Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Bob Dylan's coming to Australia, and RN can put you front row.
How does it feel? Here comes the story of the hurricane.
We're giving away loads of double passes daily to Bob's concerts right around Australia.
Hey, Mr. Dylan, play a song.
So for your chance, just add a line to our Dylan-esque song and listen to RN Drive from 6.
Thanks for coming. We'll be in the area for a few days.
This is a country breakfast on RN. Let's join our rural reporters on the road. This week, what does your local post office mean to you? We visit the small rural community of Bemboka in southern New South Wales to find out, and we get a remote-controlled drone's eye view of Andrea Hanneman's farm in South Australia. Exotic shiitake mushrooms are growing on Aussie bluegum logs, and we'll meet a couple of young Indonesian exchange students getting a taste of station life in the Northern Territory.
Fitting right in like they've been here forever. Everyone gets along fine, they're having good fun. It's a bit of an eye-opener for my followers too, because they're willing to find out more about Indonesia, and Salman and Artie want to find out more about Australia, so it's working out well.
We're off to Arvern Station a bit later, but first it's time to collect the mail.
It's a very personal job. You have to interact with people remarkably well. Discretion is absolutely essential. A sense of humour is also essential. And I just enjoy the challenge.
What does your local post office mean to you? Is it just a place to buy stamps, collect your mail and pay a few bills? Well, for residents living in and around the small community of Bemboka in southern New South Wales, it's much more than that. It's the glue that holds their community together. Hello, I'm Michael Kavner. Andrew and Sandra Judge have been running the Bemboka Post Office for the past 10 years, a marked change from their previous high-powered corporate jobs with multinational companies. Was it everything that you thought it would be when you took it up?
The business, pretty much. The lifestyle, no. We were actually worried that we were going to be missing out on social activity and that we would be bored with it in a small village. It's turned out to be totally different. The village has accepted us and there is just an incredible amount of things that we do.
There's an ATM at the pub. You also offer cash out as well. If those facilities weren't there, what would it do to the town itself, do you think?
Certainly it would take away from business in town because people would have to go into Bega or up to Cooma to do their banking and get money. Without them, people aren't going to spend in Bemboka because they'll just go into Bega, get their money and do their shopping in there. Not good for the village at all.
With a population of just over 500, there's not a lot of shops in Bemboka. There's a couple of cafes, a pub, a general store and a police station. Outside the 100-year-old timber post office building, there's a huge community billboard full of notices. Inside, Andrew is busy sorting parcels behind the counter, while Sandra renews a gun licence. Local resident Debbie Rollison has popped in to pick up her mail and have a chat.
Thank you.
It's the focal point for everybody. I mean, people come together here, maybe they're collecting mail, of course, but it's more than that. They chat, they talk, they make plans, they socialise, and I think that's really critical too. And there's a great deal of trust, a great deal of in the people that run the post office. So I think it means a lot more than just mail.
There's no delivery service around the town itself, so residents need to come in to collect their mail. But there's a separate 240-kilometre mail run to properties in the district. Sandra Judge is getting today's deliveries together.
We have a lot less mail, as in letters, but we have a lot more parcels now than we did when we first took over.
What do you put down the increase in parcels for?
Oh, online buying, eBay. People in rural and remote areas have been hard done by for a long time. What they can source locally is usually a lot more expensive than in the city. For them, the advent of eBay or online shopping means that those great discount places in Sydney are now available to them.
Mail deliveries for you is very different. The majority of people, they come in and pick up their mail, don't they?
Yes, we don't have a letterbox delivery in Bemboka itself.
So how do you actually operate the letter side of the business?
We either put it into post office boxes, so for working people that come in at odd hours, they can get their letters when it suits them. Other people just come into the post office. And for a lot of the community, that's a nice excuse to catch up with other people. And they sit out the front on the bus stop in the sun and have a nice chat. It's a social thing as well as picking up your mail.
How much then of that social thing is the need for discretion on your part?
Oh, absolutely imperative. Anything that is said in the post office stays in the post office.
Do they come along to you almost as a counsellor?
Sometimes. Sometimes people just need to get it off their chest and they know that it's not going to be blurted around, so it's healthy to get things off your chest.
You also have a mail run, but it's not just mail. You also pick up groceries for people and drop them off. How much of that is also a part of the service?
It's all part of the service. We have an elderly couple out in Tantawanglo that just love their newspaper. They're pretty much tied to the house nowadays. So we deliver their newspaper and I think the local shop gives us 20 cents for that. So it's hardly what you'd call a money-making exercise. But it's very important to them that they get it. Another family get food and horse pellets and things delivered because they just can't get out. And it's important that these people do have some form of assistance. And we're driving past their gate, so how difficult is it?
The Bemboka Post Office is vital to people like Steve Martin, who together with his wife runs a mail order business.
It's really a key to our business. If this post office wasn't here, we'd have to drive about 40 minutes and back every morning to run our mail order business. But it's also, this particular post office here is really the centre of the community. It's really the only forum in this town where you get to meet people and chat to people on a sort of a daily basis. And if you need to know anything, Sandra and Andrew here in the post office know. You just ring them up or come in and ask them. A real blessing to the community, I think.
You run a mail order business, so obviously the post office is very important to you on a day-to-day basis. But also, how much of it is a social aspect and also knowing on what's going on in the community?
Well, it's very important. There's a notice board, which we find out everything that's going on in the community. If we want to communicate with anyone, we just put something up or read it on there. And when you're new to the community, like we've been here 3 years now, but we're still needing to find out things. You know, where do you get this? Who does that? Who minds dogs when you're away, that sort of thing. Yeah, but you just find the people who run these little post offices know everyone, they deal with them every day. They never tell anyone else's business, but they're very helpful.
The parcels going in and out of the post office vary greatly. Horse pellets come and go, as do trays of tropical fruit.
Yes, we have a couple who grow for Joas commercially. They bring them in during the harvest season, which is going for about 5 to 6 weeks, we'll send out several hundred kilos of feijoas during that period of time. The restaurants, airlines, commercial businesses, it's just strange the things that come through here.
Is there anything that you've got to do that makes it a little bit different that is demanded by Australia Post when you're sending something like that?
Any food stuff has to be packed well so that it's not going to leak or be crushed. If it's something like a chilli, we want to make sure that we don't have chilli juice squeezed over everything, so that would have to be in an almost airtight, liquid-proof container. Interestingly, we get truffles come in. We get people who make cheese down here, and they'll bring cultures in, and they'll ask for truffles to be sent in, and they will send samples of cheeses out. So it's always an interesting job.
So we're ready for action, Rook. So we'll see if we can crush it.
Like many farmers, Andrea Hanneman likes to take photographs, recording everyday events around the farm and posting them on social media for everyone to see. And now she can offer a different perspective of the sheep yards and the paddocks with the help of this little machine in front of me.
So that's the air drone. So it's now Wi-Fi'd with that. So it sends back the video and the pictures.
Now, Andrea's bought herself a recreational drone, a remote-controlled aerial device which can take happy snaps and videos from up in the sky. Hello, I'm Brooke Neindorf, and I've joined Andrea on her farm near Cleve on South Australia's Eyre Peninsula to see how it works.
I've been taking flying lessons. I bought myself a drone and I'm learning to fly it so I can take some photos.
That's just the main reason to take photos?
Yeah, it's recreational use only. It's not actually a farm workhorse. It's more like a bit of a hobby, really.
How long have you had it for?
Well, I've had it for about 4 or 5 months, and I've just been practicing to flying, and now I'm a little bit confident I can get up there and take some shots of our farming operation that we do.
So learning to fly it, how's that going?
Well, I'm not very skilled. I've got a lot of work to do yet. I think if you were an Xbox player, you'd be very good at it, but my spatial ability is a bit limited, so when it sort of goes in reverse, you know, for me to use the reverse controls is a bit challenging, but I'm getting there.
Have you had any major crashes?
Of course. I actually have. I did crash and I broke a rotor and I broke a cog. So I did what every normal person would do. I got onto Google, I YouTubed it, I found out what I needed to buy, I bought it and I fixed it myself.
So you'll be a drone pilot and mechanic before you know it?
Well, I think so, yeah.
And so you've been taking a few photos. What have you been documenting so far?
Well, I've been just flying up over the house and taking our agricultural machinery. I've also done a little bit of, we did landmarking, so I've taken some photos of that. And I guess the idea is that I just want to take some photos with a different perspective of farming. I really like to put up photos of farming, and I just think that a picture says 1,000 words and it gives people an idea of what we do.
What's been some of the feedback that you've got from the drone photos?
People just love the perspective. They love the height, you know, and I do too, you know, and I get up over our buildings and you can see the rusty iron on the front, you know, like on the top of the roof. It's just a different way of looking at things.
And what about your husband, Mark? How has he had taken it?
Well, he has had nothing to do with it. He's not a fan, probably.
All right, well, we might duck outside and have a go.
I think we should definitely go for a fly, Brooke, and I reckon we could even take a photo of us together. What do you reckon?
What do you saw the other day? What's that called? A drelfie.
That's it. I think we should do that. So here's my app. Load the app, put it in pilot mode.
And it's that simple.
It is that simple.
And that saves all the photos and videos that you do on there?
Yeah, it streams them down, straight down, and saves them on your iPad.
I notice there's a big red emergency button up the top. Have you had to use that yet?
No. Emergency actually turns the rotors off and it just falls to the ground, so it's not a good button. Just landing works well. Or rescue, that's if you get caught in a tree, so it's very basic. Let's go. I might even not be able to put up very high. You know, this
is that wind.
Yeah. Which is, you know, just makes you realise how limited it is. So we'll see. The sheepdog actually tries to bite it, so it's not a fan. They don't like it much.
So explain to us what you're doing here with your piloting. Well,
you download an app and they just have like a height, so up and down, sideways, and then you can spin your camera around. There's a camera at the front which takes videos, and there's also a camera mounted on the bottom, so you can take a shot down, looking straight down, but the pixels on that aren't quite good enough, so I tend just to use the front camera, which is fine for what I need to do. So it's enough tech for me.
It's good exercise for him, anyway.
Yeah, it is good exercise for him.
Yes, Vinny the sheepdog trying his best to catch that drone on Andrea Hanneman's farm on South Australia's Eyre Peninsula. Still to come today, Indonesian exchange students try their hand at being ringers on a territory cattle property, and they're growing true blue shiitake mushrooms in Victoria.
Traditionally, shiitake grow on oak logs, which is what the shi is. Shi means a type of Japanese oak, and take is mushroom. So literally they're oak mushrooms. We don't have a big supply of oak in the area, so we've experimented with different types of eucalypts. I think they'd grow on a very wide range, but it depends what you've got in the area.
Fungus spores, eucalyptus logs, and lots of patience. That's what it takes to transform felled timber into a commercial shiitake mushroom crop. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington at Colac in southern Victoria, where farmer Rob Worthamer has been experimenting with growing shiitakes for the past 5 years. It's taken a fair bit of trial and error to get this operation this far, and the work is still ongoing. Now, I've joined Rob in his mushroom shed to see what's involved in producing this high-end boutique crop, beginning with the all-important host logs.
The ones that you're seeing here are all out of plantations north of Colac, up around Lismore, but we harvest thinnings out of plantations on farmers' land anywhere around this area. So if someone's got a blue gum plantation or a sugar gum plantation that needs thinning, we're happy to go in and do that and take the logs as a reward.
And so when you bring those logs back, can you talk us through the process of what happens when you get back here?
We generally cut in winter. We try and get the logs back here as fast as possible. Some shiitake growers will wait a couple of weeks before they inoculate. We don't bother with that. We inoculate straight away. The logs are cut. They're all cut to a standard 1 metre length. When we bring them back here, we drill roughly 50 holes in each log, and then we hammer in small dowels which have been inoculated with shiitake mycelium.
So where we are here, we can see the pallets with the logs kind of stacked up. We've got 4x4. What happens at this point?
At this point, they've just been inoculated. We've stacked them up and they're in pallets of anything from about 30 to 42 logs. Then we wait. We keep the logs moist. It's important to keep the moisture content fairly high. We wait for around about 9 months. It can happen in as few as 6 months, or it can stretch out to 12 months. It depends on the weather. Once they start to show signs of the mycelium having run through the log, the mycelium is the actual organism that is the shiitake organism. It's a type of fungi that feeds off the starches in dead wood.
And so then once you're at that point, where do we go from there?
At that point, you need to give the log a signal that it's ready to fruit, and there are different signals. Some people bang the logs. I think a lot of Japanese farmers use that method, but we shock the logs by putting them into cold water. And so we pick up a pallet of logs with our forklift and just drop it into a tank. About 3 or 4 days later, you'll get what's called pinning, or the emergence of the small mushrooms. And then after 10 days from the point that you put them in the water, you should have a crop ready to harvest. Mm. It depends on the weather, but they will probably keep fruiting for about a week. And so we harvest twice a day, every day for that week. And then when the log's not putting any more mushrooms out, they're restacked.
So where to from here with your business? Do you look to expand the restaurants you supply into, or do you feel you're at a level where you can maintain the demand that's there?
Look, at the moment, we still haven't proved it as a commercially viable business. We've been doing it for 5 years. We're yet to make a profit. We've been plagued by all the sorts of problems that you would expect in a startup business, and particularly a startup business where there's no expertise in the country to call on when you come across a problem. We're doing another inoculation this winter. We're combining all the knowledge that we've put together over the last 5 years to try and get that particular run correct, and we'll look at the results after that. Okay, so this is our fruiting shed. We purpose-built the shed about 2 years ago. It's a fully insulated shed with a concrete floor and hydronic heating through the floor, which is hooked up to a big solar thermal plant outside. This is what makes log-grown shiitake so difficult. There's a lot of labour involved. After we've dunked the logs to shock them into production, we have to bring them into the fruiting shed here and then hand load them onto these racks. And they'll stay on these racks for anything up to 2 weeks. And then we have to restack them all. So there's a lot of handwork in it.
So what's your favourite way of taking in a shiitake?
Look, we have some fabulous chefs do all sorts of interesting things with them, and I've tasted many amazing shiitake dishes, but Kirill and I both agree our favourite way is just to tear them up, pour some boiling hot water over them and add some miso soup, and we'll drink that all day. It's absolutely fantastic.
So it's probably a good thing that you enjoy the shiitakes then, since you're surrounded by them.
It is. It's hard to get enough of them.
They're fitting right in like they've been here forever. Everyone gets along fine, they're having good fun. It's a bit of an eye-opener for my followers too, because they're willing to find out more about Indonesia and Salman and Ardi want to find out more about Australia, so it's working out well.
For young Indonesian university students Ade Karyani and Saman Hafid, the chance to work on a top-end cattle station is something of a dream come true. The pair has spent the past 3 weeks at Auvergne Station, 350 kilometres southwest of Katherine, as part of an industry exchange program run by the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association. They've been gaining practical hands-on experience in a range of skills. They've been fencing, cattle drafting and pregnancy testing, even spending a few nights camping out in their swags looking at the stars. Hello, I'm Carmen Brown. And while it sounds like, and is, a lot of fun, the program has a serious aim: to build a close partnership with Northern Australia's most important trading partner. Dave Young is head stockman here on Auvergne and responsible for training these keen Indonesian ringers.
Yeah, it's a great thing, I reckon. Salman and Ardi seem to be having a lot of fun, and like, it's all new to them what we're doing, and it's completely different to what they know, but it's not stopping them. They're getting right in and having a good time and doing the job.
Now, have you been teaching them a few swear words, a few slang words, some sort of, I guess, our Aussie culture, you might call it?
Not me, for say, but...
Of course not.
Nah, they're going well. They're sort of helping these fellows learn a bit of Indonesian, and our blokes are teaching them a bit of Aussie slang.
The student program's been running for 3 years now, and so far it seems to be delivering what it set out to achieve. For Salman Hafid, the program is all about gaining hands-on experience. And over the past few weeks, he's had a go at just about every job on the station.
In this morning, we was drafting, and now is we are doing is pre-testing for the cell cows. This is the Mr. Dev was practicing on there, and I'm here, and this Charlie to make sure handling cattle from the dad's yard to the next race.
And has Dave, the head stockman there, has he had you up there helping with the preg testing?
Yes, I was try once, and that is so amazing.
Have you ever done anything like that before?
Yeah, I was study about the preg testing, but it's different because in there is maybe just 1 minute, one person, because that is the university and too many people. And here I can use my hand and I can feel this is a calf in the cow. Yes, it's pregnant.
What else have they had you doing on the station? There's lots of work that goes into running a cattle station. What else have they had you doing?
So many. Because we in here was 4 weeks in here, and we was doing everything, like handling cattle with the horse, so many cattle with horse, and we bring the cows is from the paddock to the another paddock, and with the horse. This is a new experience for me because I never tried that in my country. This is amazing.
And have they had you camping out? Have you spent a few nights out in the swag?
Yeah, like camping every day. That's good because we can see the star, you know, and the people in here is so good. They walk from dark to dark, you know, and that is the walk before the sunrise and after sunset.
Yeah. They are hard workers on stations. It is long, long days. How have you found that? You've been a bit tired?
Yes, tired is good for me.
So you've never seen anything quite like this, have you?
Yeah, I've never seen like this because I was the fencing, you know, fencing with the Toyota in fencing from the paddock to the other paddock. There's so big paddock and that's great.
You do have a big smile on your face, which says to me you are having a good time. Yeah. Do you think you might see yourself coming back to Australia and to the Northern Territory in the future and maybe working on one of these stations full time?
Yeah, that is my dream. Yeah, I like this place and I hope I can back to this place again. And maybe for the next time I can work in here or maybe study in here. That is good country.
Salman Hafid, obviously enjoying his time as a ringer on Arverne Station in the Northern Territory. Thanks to Carmen Brown for that story. I'm Edwina Farley and you're with A Country Breakfast on RN. In a moment, we'll celebrate the strong connections between Indigenous and rural Australia.
Next on the Health Report, some remarkable and controversial findings about mother's milk.
The calories in mother's milk, so if it came with a little, you know, label on the back telling you how many calories there were, combined with the volume of milk that mothers are producing. When you look at that at a critical window of behavioral development at 1 month of age, it actually predicts the infant's behavior months later.
That's Mother's Milk, How Sweet It Is, with me, Norman Swan, on Monday afternoon at 5:30 here on RN.
The Indigenous men and women who worked for rations and helped to build Australia's northern cattle industry are at the heart of a special art exhibition launched in the Kimberley. It's called In the Saddle on the Wall, and it features the works of 13 well-known Aboriginal artists who've painted their memories of station life, both the highs and the lows. Our reporter Matt Brand was at the launch.
Oh.
Aboriginal artists from across the Kimberley region of Western Australia have travelled to Kununurra to launch an exhibition called In the Saddle, On the Wall. It's a collection of paintings, short films and traditional dancing, and it's celebrating the history and the connection that Aboriginal people have for the North's pastoral industry. One of the organisers of tonight is Beth Neat from ABC Open. What's happening here, Beth?
Well, Matt, it's very exciting. We've got dozens of people coming through the doors at the moment. 13 artists and their families have helped put together tonight. And those artists were selected because they were the senior station workers. They were the head stockmen, they were the head girls in the house. And tonight's all about remembering their past and reconnecting them with the cattle stations.
And the night includes some fantastic tuckera as well, a bit of damper, and a fresh killer is on the cards, is that right?
That's right. So a lot of people have shown a lot of interest in tonight, including people who are living on the stations today. And we're very lucky this week that Mike Shaw, who's the manager out there at Spring Creek, he thought he'd come by and drop a couple of eskies full of ribs, which went down a treat with the mob here. They were very grateful.
Hello, my name is Dora Griffiths. I am a chairperson for the Wurundjeri Aboriginal Arts and a artist as well. It's my mum and dad who grew up in the cattle stations. They were in this exhibition in the Saddle on the Wall. They said a little bit of story about their life as they were growing up as childhood until they were teenagers.
And that's what they paint?
That's what my dad paints. My mum paints her mother's country out at Bubble Bubble in the Keep River National Park in the Northern Territory. My dad paints the Victoria River through to Timber Creek.
All the stories we've heard tonight, such fond memories about growing up on cattle stations. Why do you think it was such a great life?
In those days, it was a great life and good living area until the town started up, and then we had elders that didn't forget about their past and where they were from. And when the art industry started up in Kununurra, it's like they went out to their community or to their land where they were from, where they were born. Then they'd come back, sit down, get a board, and just paint away.
That's how the art movement was born. All these kind of ex-ringers and station people painting.
Yep, that's how it was came up alive.
A lot of young people here tonight.
Yep.
What do you hope they've learned and got out of a night like tonight?
I hope they will keep up the culture, keep up their dance, keep up the history stories of their grandparents, their great-great-grandparents.
Yeah, my name's Tom Shepherd. I manage Newry. A lot of these elders now call it Murrumurra. I don't know what it means, but I know where the story is. They tell me about it, but yeah, I've been out there for about over 4 years now.
And why did you come here tonight?
Oh, just because I knew a few of the old traditional owners and that, and heard it was on, so just come in to have a look. They rang us up and asked us about it, and yeah, thought it'd be a good thing to come and have a look at, bring the kids along.
And telling those old stories about Newry tonight, how did that make you feel?
Yeah, no, it's sort of it's interesting, and I sort of have a fair bit to do with them out there too. You know, it's I like history and that, and I was at Humbert River before I come here and got to know a lot of them people over there too, and a lot of history that went on and that, and it's sort of all interesting, that stuff.
Are there Indigenous stockmen on Newry these days?
I had a couple there a couple of years ago. They were there. One fella went back to Dumagee, and and another fella's working in Catherine now, but yeah, they were sort of keen young fellas, yeah.
And hopefully the rest of Australia is going to see this work and see these paintings about station life. What would you say to all those city people who might get a chance to see this?
Oh, get out and have a look at real Australia. Not, you know, don't be narrow-minded about it and get out and have a look at the real thing, you know.
And that was Tom Shepherd, the current station manager of Newry Station in the Northern Territory. Now, the last of Queensland's Aboriginal trackers has called it a day. Barry Port has been helping Queensland Police in the state's far north for the past 36 years. He honed his skills by tracking wandering livestock on a large cattle station, a skill he learned from his father and was then enlisted to track people.
My name's Barry Port from Cowan. I live in Cowan all my life. In the early days I used to travel around, worked on a lot of cattle stations, and we used to drive a lot of cattle across to Moriba. There was no transport to Moriba. Cowan to Moriba and from around the cattle station. So born here in Cowan, yep, up the bank of the Lankilly River, way back in 1942.
And what's your country, Barry?
I'm a Lumlama tribe. That's where my parents come from, way down Port Stewart. That's down the east coast. It's all saltwater country. Well, Dad learned me how to track and find fuse. When we used to work on a cattle station like that, look for cattle and horses and look for their track and which way they're heading to, and you have to find them and bring them back to the camp. Well, when you work on a cattle station, you have to learn a lot of these, how to track horses and find horses when they walk away off the camp. You have to find them and bring them back to the camp.
What about people? Are they hard to find?
Yeah, we had a few people got lost here in Cowan and outside of Cowan. And they was pretty hard to find. We just go and look for tracks until we find them. A couple of bodies we still never find. They're still missing.
How do you find a set of tracks in the middle of the bush?
Oh, they sort of turns up along a bit of a track. Then they follow that along. And you just follow the tracks along then until you come across them. Or if not, they follow the river, riverbed. They walk along the river. Just only looking for this footprint, that's all.
When did you decide to start getting involved with police work?
Well, I used to help out a few little odds and ends if they wanted the horses before I started working, if they wanted a horse. And I worked on a cattle station here in Cowan, and I round up a few head of horses for them and go with the police and go and look for them who's get lost or something. That's how I ended up with them. That was a few years ago. I work with police for 36 years now. Yeah, wherever they go, I go with them. Yeah. They just had a job here, vacancy, and then way back in the 80s, I applied for it and I got it. That's how I end up working here till today.
How has this place changed since then, Barry? We're just looking at some of the old buildings on the police grounds here. What are they?
Well, these old buildings, the old trackers' hut, and long before my time, when I was a little fellow, they had horses, and they go out patrol on horses. Long before my time, they used to have three trackers here, but the old fellas all dead and gone now.
How do you feel knowing that you're the last one, the last police tracker to work for the Queensland Police Service?
I feel really good. I'm not sort of... Yeah, I feel really good, yeah, working with them.
Are you worried that the skills will be lost from the service, though? The tracking skills, the bush skills that you had?
Well, I told them, I said, I won't be too far away. If they need any help, I'll be back here to help them out.
And it's good to hear he's not going too far. Barry Port there, the last of Queensland Police's Aboriginal trackers, speaking with Charlie McKillop in Cowan in far north Queensland. Now, in recent years, bush tucker has started to grace the dinner plates, both in restaurants and at home. And a group of young Indigenous women attending high school in Pambula, Bombala and Eden on the New South Wales far south coast are working to bring back a food that was once prolific on the Monero. They're being led by community elder Eileen Blackburn as they attempt to propagate yams, which will then be transplanted on the Bundian Way, a network which had cultural and trade significance and it covered large parts of Gippsland in Victoria right up to the high country. Eileen says apart from nutritional value, the yam has other qualities.
Traditionally, the yam fields would be go for hundreds and hundreds of miles. There were no fences, you see. There were no cattle. There were no sheep, there weren't the feral animals that we have today. Initially, we were just looking at the revitalisation of the yam, the plant itself, and we know that it's significant in terms of the women. We've tried to encompass those cultural protocols to keep the integrity of what the yam's about.
Now, in front of us, there are five different pots of different sorts of yams. What were these yams for?
It's mainly a staple source of food. Despite the weather condition, the yam was like a reliable source of food.
How would you cook and eat them?
Oh, look, you could eat them raw. You can steam them, you can roast them, you could bake them, you could crush them up, you could do whatever you like with them. You don't have to just eat the roots by themselves, you can eat the whole plant, which is the stem and the roots. They're all quite delicious. It's one of those foods that can be applied to whatever you're cooking.
Once you propagate these and they're back in substantial numbers on the Monero, would you like to see them being used again as food?
Yeah. That's right. Well, they're known for their healing. Physically, if you eat them, you know, they're good for you, but they also have a well-being in terms of healing. Women know they have that healing capacity. That's why they're so special.
How difficult are they to propagate?
They're really fickle little things. They're fussy, very fussy plant. They're not
like a woman?
That's probably got something to do with it. But they're not like a tomato plant or like other veggies and fruit that you can grow. They're sensitive to the weather. They're sensitive to the water. They're sensitive to soil. So that's the challenge that we have with replenishing the yams. On the other hand, they do grow in abundance, you know, on the Monero tablelands and the plains from Canberra right down to the border and further. Relocating them, that's going to be an interesting challenge for us because like orchids, like a lot of our native plants, they grow well. They don't necessarily adjust to being taken out of their natural environment.
And the yams themselves, would you recommend people possibly propagating them for their own backyard and using them as an alternative food source?
Oh, yeah. As an alternative to just normal onions, they're quite tasty and they're adaptable, they're flexible. You can throw them into a salad or you could do what you would do with lots of other plants and veggies.
You also mentioned they're baked and they're steamed. How would you steam them?
Roll them up into bark. You could bake them, steam them. So they're not a food that you have to do in any one particular way.
Annabelle Dora is working with a group bringing a scientific background to combine it with traditional knowledge.
In the travelling stock reserves, we do find quite large populations. Because they haven't had constant grazing, they seem to have survived quite well. And propagation, well, we're really only beginning. The yam daisy propagates quite well, but we're only at the very beginning of the project, so we'll find that out.
You've got five different types of yams sitting in the pots. Would they be planted once they're going well in the mud brick hut, and then you take them out onto the Monero? Would you expect to plant them in different places?
Yes, we're expecting to plant them all along the Bundian Way and anywhere that yams would have occurred naturally.
And have you tasted any of them yourself yet?
I've tasted the yam daisy and vanilla lily. I have enjoyed them, despite your doubts.
How did you have them?
Just raw. Just bit them.
The mortar course is about a 25mm thick layer.
To propagate the yams, a mud brick hut is being built at Jigamy Farm, south of Pambula. Lindsay Caldwell has worked with the young women making the bricks to construct the hut.
It's good for young people to find out that there are other ways of building other than the traditional ways. Well, this certainly is a traditional way. I think they're learning something, which is good.
What in particular have you noticed while working with the young women of different ages that have come in, first of all, to be involved in the traditional growth of the yams, and now they've got involved with the mud hut?
Well, they've all been very positive and willing to have a go, which is what we need.
Any major disasters when you're working with mud?
There's always major disasters working with mud. In this case, the material for the bricks was a little bit light on clay, and so we've had a few failures there, but with the mud bricks, if you can get them into the wall, then they're okay. You can fix them up from there.
And that's Lindsay Caldwell, who's helping young Indigenous women make a mud brick hut to help with propagating yams, finishing Michael Kavanagh's story. Now, young Indigenous men from Western Australia's Kimberley are having some life-changing experiences thanks to a local ranger program. The year-long course takes high school students out of the classroom and into the paddock to teach them about livestock. Now, the program's enabling boys who aren't enjoying school to become qualified, but also to get paying jobs. Tyne McConnon has the story.
All right, boys, after I'll finish eating, go down there and get 3 bales of hay and push it down into the yard and shut the gates behind us so the horse don't get hurt.
When me and Chappie first started off, you know, we didn't think much of ourselves and, yeah, we just didn't really back ourselves up and today's, yeah, we just look at it a different way. Yeah, it makes you feel good and confident and stuff like that.
Jason Reed and Jason Chappie Woodman are two young men who are now employed at Yeehaw Riding School. Both started the Ranger program last year, which has given them certificates in agriculture and now a full-time paying job. Chris Thomas runs the program.
The Rangers program was a federally funded initiative that started 2 years ago, and there were 14 schools in Australia-wide that were run as pilot programs to deliver a cert to in conservation and land management. I was approached by the school to run the program out here, and I said the only way I would do it was using horses as a carrot, as a draw card. It's going for all of this year, as well as doing this here to add some of the students on there. We run with about 8 to 10 students. Some of the students are also doing school-based traineeships as part of that CERTUAG with us. But unfortunately, the funding runs out at the end of this year, so we are looking at other alternatives, other ways to continue the funding, because the program is seen not just by us as a success, but by everybody else in the community as well. It's not just saying that the guys who go through the program are going to go out and work on stations. They've got opportunities then to go out and work in tourism or to go out and work in general agriculture. But also, it's the programs are giving them hope for the future, realising that they can do a full day's work, and that can lead on to employment anywhere then.
If that program or if this program wasn't in place, what do you think these boys would be doing or what could they do as another option?
Current, they'd basically be on the streets. They wouldn't be attending anyway. There isn't much else for them. They don't quite fit into the normal everyday school system. They've been non-attenders for so long, it's very hard for them to fit back in now. When they come out here and you know, our whole thing is about the horses, and every job they do is to do for the safety and the welfare of the horses. So they'll dig holes all day, or they'll walk through paddocks scrubbing for walkabout. Because of the love of the horse, they don't mind doing it, they enjoy doing it.
The pride in the Ranger program is evident from the moment you walk into the school. The two young men are standing tall, hats on, shirts freshly pressed with clean jeans. You can't help but notice the younger children following their every word. Jason Reed and Jason Chappie Woodman say the program has changed their lives, and now they are helping run the program this year.
Hi, my name is Jason Woodman and I've been at Yeehaw for 2 years. I started off from the Rangers program. Yeah, we came out here and I didn't have anything to do with the horses or anything like that. Didn't go near a horse or anything like that. And so Chris threw me on a horse. And then, yeah, that's how I loved it. And I really liked the horse and all that, you know.
Do you think you'll be around horses for the rest of your life now?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I will, yeah. Around bulls and horses.
Hi, I'm Jason Reed, and I've been working at Yeehaw Trail Rides for 2 years now.
You do so many things out here at the moment. You do things from taking people on trail rides to looking after your own horses to building fences and looking after boars, but what's your favourite part?
The favourite part would probably be with the Indigenous Rangers, seeing from where the boys have been to where they are now. So, like, some of the boys might have just been at home, just sitting around and walking the streets and stuff, and now they actually want to help their little brothers get a good life and help them out, you know, and like get them on a good track. There's not really much people that show them the right way to what to do and like how to live a good life. So this program sort of shows them how to get a good job, hopefully get a good home and car and all that sort of stuff.
Jason Reed there from Yeehaw Riding School. And that's the program for this week. You can enjoy the full sweep of ABC coverage of celebrations for NAIDOC Week online at abc.net.au/NAIDOC or find those individual stories at ABC Rural. Don't forget, you can join the conversation anytime via social media. Look for me, Edwina Farley, or follow the hashtag Rural Breakfast. Thanks to technical producer Nick Mearish. I'll be with you again next week.
In today's culture, food is everything, and yet society is arguably more removed from the realities of food production than at any time in human history. On Future Tense this week, a panel discussion recorded at the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, examining the realities of today's food culture and how we can guarantee future food supplies. That's Future Tense. Download the program from the RN website or look for us on iTunes.